I'm Eric Zelo.
I'm Arthur Anderson.
And this past semester, we had an opportunity to do something really cool.
We had the chance to team teach a class with a bunch of students and get them out in the field doing some archaeology, get them down in the archives, doing some hands-on history, and explore a part of the history of our campus that had pretty well been forgotten, and something that even we were unaware of.
Yeah, it all began when I saw a picture, a photograph of what's now our main academic and administrative building, DeCary Hall. And there was this house in front of it, a house that's not there anymore. The reality of this class was that we didn't know really what we would find. We had this house that showed up in a photograph in front of our main academic building, DeCary Hall, and we didn't know anything else. We didn't know if we'd find anything in the ground. We didn't know what the story of the house was. We knew essentially nothing other than the basic existence of the house.
And your relaxed tone there, Eric, really reflects the fact that this was so successful, because if we had tried to record this or an introduction like this in the first week of the course, we would have been unable to conceal the terror in our voices that we might just haul a group of students out into the front yard of our main academic building and dig a bunch of holes and find nothing and rifle through the archives with the assistance of a lot of great folks at the library and find nothing. And this whole thing would sort of fall apart.
There was a level of fear. I'm not going to lie. Over the summer, as we were getting ready for the class, though, it became clearer that at least on the archival side, things were going to be okay. Because, well, initially I wasn't so sure, I admit, because I was finding all kinds of stuff about another house. Our house was, we later found, we learned, called the Wayside initially. The other house that I was finding all kinds of stuff was right next door, and it was called the Willows. And what I learned about that house is that the principal owner of the house, Abby Flood, ran a shore dinner hall there. And that seemed sort of exciting. Then we started looking into the Wayside, and
It was harder to find more information, a lot of apparently conflicting and overlapping information. It was sometimes hard to tell what house, what family, what these records were pointing to. But we persevered and started to make sense of things, and that brought us to a story of one family running competing shore dinner halls about 50 feet apart from each other.
This was like crazy. It turns out that the Wayside is a shore dinner hall too. And then that raises all sorts of questions. It's how on earth can one place, one little sort of 100-meter place, support two shore dinner halls that are apparently both doing exceedingly well? And so the second episode of our podcast series is really about that. Where do these shore dinner halls come from? How do they fit into the larger leisure regime of an area that now is associated with tourism, but in the 19th century was farming and fishing?
Yeah, what's that transition between producing for market and deciding that the real opportunity is opening up your home to sell the clams and the corn to people that are coming directly to you in search of an experience?
I mean, this is a story of scrappy New Englanders really kind of figuring out how to make sense of change. We'll think you really enjoy this one.
Welcome back. In this episode, we're taking the ferry from the Biddeford City Center, almost 8 miles down the shore, to uncover the forgotten tales of tourism and shore dinner halls, a vibrant slice of coastal life in Maine's past. Over the course of 2 months, we dug deep, literally and figuratively, into this site, unearthing pieces of history, one artifact at a time. So grab a seat at the virtual shore dinner table, and let's dive in.
Over 5 days, we excavated 8 test pits at the site of the historic Flood Shore Dinner Hall, carefully uncovering artifacts that paint a piece of the picture of life at this coastal retreat. Currently located in front of DeCary Hall on the University of New England's main campus. We're on site, trowels in hand, finding fragments of the past nails, clamshell shards, and pottery pieces emerging from the earth like whispers of history. What was our most exciting discovery? It was a large portion of a plate, likely used for serving guests in the dining hall, alongside a piece of a sink bowl and the hall's foundation found in 4 of our connected test pits. The foundation stones and sink bowl give us hints as to the structure and the daily operations of the Shore Dinner Hall. This site is about artifacts and the story of tourism and the community through these items. Shore dinner halls would often be a place of public and private parties with mentions in newspapers throughout the years. Shore dinner halls were therefore lively places where locals and visitors alike joined in to have a meal from the sea while creating bonds, as they were never-ending public parties from hall to hall. Imagine the bustling kitchen, the clatter of dishes, the laughter of guests enjoying their meals. These halls thrived with the transportation improvement that made the coast accessible by train, ferry, and eventually automobiles to the city people seeking rest and recreation. As we delve deeper into this story, we will examine the rise of coastal tourism, the workers who kept the hall running, and the meals that brought people together. Most of the story revolves around Hills Beach and its surrounding area. To orient our listeners, Hills Beach is an area located at the mouth of the Saco River in the city of Biddeford, Maine. Right across the Biddeford Pool's narrow channel, also called the Gut, is the Biddeford Pool neighborhood, and further down the road from Biddeford Pool is Fortune's Rocks. These seaside communities make up the area around the Flood House and are the focus of our story today. With the arrival of the Industrial Revolution, the Biddeford textile mills offered new growth within the town. Technological advances in transportation contributed to that growth, reduced travel time, and offered accessibility to areas of the nation that previously would have taken weeks to travel to. In 1842, the Grand Trunk Railroad was completed, connecting Saco and Biddeford to Montreal. In addition, that same year, the Old Orchard and Ferry beaches were linked by a steam railroad. People escaping the smelly heat of the urban areas boarded the train to the cool, calming areas of the ocean.
An advertisement from the time encourages Bostonians to hop on an overnight boat that left Boston Harbor at about 7 p.m. and arrived in Portland, Maine, with enough time to hop on the train down to Old Orchard Beach and, quote, enjoy a sunrise breakfast. It was the golden age of leisure.
The trip from the city to the coast took a full day, bouncing along the rutted pool road behind a horse. Once the automobile became a fixture of life, that trip would drop down to hours, if not minutes. However, the 1900s saw many changes to the landscape of Biddeford once again. After interviewing Emma Bouthillette, author of A Brief History of Biddeford, we gained some valuable insights into the area. In the early 1900s, Biddeford was a booming industrial town, with the textile mills drawing people in for job opportunities. Not to mention that Biddeford provided those living there with everything they needed and within the city. People during this time had no need to travel outside the city, since all of their needs were met in one place. Emma shed some light on this.
Growing up, I used to hear my grandparents talk about how they got everything they needed downtown. They lived close to downtown. Everybody walked around. There were butchers and grocers and clothing shops, and all of their needs were met in this like one square mile of area.
By 1910, Biddeford was the fourth largest city in Maine. Many who lived in Biddeford began expanding outside the city, developing the coastal areas with summer homes, cottages, and hotels, giving rise to a new set of needs.
The journey to some of those small coastal areas was long, with winding roads that took longer to traverse than they would today. Not only were the roads difficult to navigate, but vehicles are not what they are today, and what would be a short drive today could take hours then.
Again, to have the convenience of being able to get something in a small community versus having to take a carriage or ride a horse or whatever the mode of transportation was, walking even, took much longer, obviously, to get in town, Biddeford. So there was this need to have these types of places closer by.
The travel time gave rise to shore dinner halls. Shore dinner halls began cropping up all over areas like Old Orchard, Old Pool Road, and Hills Beach. Having the ability to stop in small communities for food and rest was incredibly convenient.
These halls weren't just places to eat. They were social hubs. Local visitors gathered for public and private events, creating bonds over steamed clams, lobster stew, fried clams.
Maine farmers and fishermen pivoted to meet the increasing demand of food from the cities of Saco and Biddeford and the Boston area. Local historian Susan Graham describes this phenomenon.
In the 1860s and 70s, there were at least 70 farms there. York County was a breadbasket for Boston even, because the trains used to carry produce and eggs and whatever, dairy, to Boston. So it was kind of a natural that food would have grown out of that because it was readily available.
With the influx of people, business opportunities arose. Large farmhouses became the first hotels, and shore dinner halls began to crop up. Graham discusses the origin of the Curtis Farm in Shore Dinners.
I did find records that the Curtis Farm Inn not only served meals to their guests, but it was open to the public, and people from Biddeford used to organize events to go down to Fortune's Rocks to eat at the Curtis Inn. Often they were served chowder, you know, from the dairy farm, and whatever was in the chowder was probably from the sea. The man who operated the Curtis Farm had his own lobster traps. And it was probably no regulation then.
By reading local newspapers, our group has discovered that a shore dinner could be held privately or commercially.
An advertisement from 1916 for Moulton's Shore Dinner described a feast that could rival any modern seafood spread. Quote, "There are two kinds of people, those who know a good dinner and those who do not. Which class are you in? We cater to those who know. Moulton's 75-cent shore dinner. Steamed clams, clam bouillon, drawn butter, lobster stew with crackers and pickles, fried clams in hot rolls, french fried potatoes, plain lobster, ice cream, cakes, coffee. Moulton House, Dunstan."
The society pages are full of stories regaling the shore dinner.
A clipping from the Biddeford Weekly Journal in September of 1912 reads, quote, "Shore dinner enjoyed. Gathering at cottage of Maurice Clements at Fortune's Rocks. There was a happy gathering at the cottage of Mr. and Mrs. Maurice Clement of Lewiston at Fortune's Rocks, Thursday, August 29th, the occasion being a shore dinner given by Mr. and Mrs. Clement to relatives and friends in this city. It was a delightful affair and will long be remembered by those present. John I.I. Joy of the Pool Road officiated as a master of ceremonies and attended to his duties like an old-timer."
A journalist from the Biddeford Daily Journal in June of 1928 writes about Huff's, a Shore Dinner Hall on Poole Road. On the right, a short distance back from the river and easily reached by this boat, are one or two shore dinner resorts. And if the imagination is vivid, we can almost smell the savory lobster and succulent clams. Close to the shore, shaded by the trees, stands the little house and outbuildings once the famous eating place known far and wide as Huff's, where Uncle Charles, with his garden and his famous wife, known to hundreds as Aunt Mary Huff, lived, and where she started the business which gave rise to the well-known Poole Road Shore Dinner. Better than any shore dinner served farther east. On the Huff Register were names of visitors from Maine to California. Indeed, people from all over the country are recorded in the Flood Shore Dinner's guestbook. A prominent entry is August 17, 1913, where 8 people's signatures are highlighted in the guestbook as the Hungry Mob, their residences ranging from Portland, Maine to Brooklyn, New York. Local historian and generational resident of Biddeford Pool, Peter McFeeters, provided insight into the coastal hotel industry.
Originally, the original summer people here were really just renting rooms from the locals, or, you know, the earliest inns were just, you know, big houses that had spare rooms, and these people rented rooms for the summer, and then the hotels started springing up because there was more and more demand.
All good things, unfortunately, must come to an end. The golden age of shore dinner halls faded in the post-war era as the automobile made travel easier and second homes replaced social hotels.
In the first decade of the 1900s, there were 4 hotels in the Fortunes Rocks area. By the 1950s, there were none. On October 20th, 1947, smoke began to fill the air. The summer had been a record season of drought and record heat, with over 90 days with no rain. Maine was a timber box waiting to combust. The fires began in the western part of York County and moved rapidly towards the coast, devastating Fortune's Rocks.
And in the process of rebuilding, no commercial buildings were constructed. The tragedy that day, among others, is described by Joyce Butler in her book, Wildfire Loose, The Week Maine Burned, where a paragraph describes the Spafford family valiantly attempting to save their home in Granite Point, saying that they, quote, wet down their house with a garden hose until the pressure failed. They then filled buckets and tubs and set them around the house. As burning debris carried by the wind fell in the grass, setting it afire, they wet brooms in the buckets and beat the flames out. Bushes beside the garage caught fire. The house across the street and others on Granite Point Road burned, but the Spaffords did as well. End quote.
The story is one of hardships in the post-war era. Peter McFeeters recalls the event.
My wife's grandmother, who was running the Ocean View Hotel, which is the big one on the beach, she couldn't find any help. She said that so many of the GIs came home from the war and went to college on the GI Bill and had other things going on that, you know, she couldn't find the summer help that she was accustomed to finding. And my mother-in-law talked about her mother falling upstairs at night because she had been a large part of cooking all the meals and doing all the dishes and making all the beds, and, you know, just an enormous amount of work.
In Biddeford Pool at the turn of the century, there were at least 3 hotels, with one, the Ocean View Inn, lasting all the way until the 1980s, when it was finally sold and turned into a convent, which has since been torn down to turn it into a park. What happened to the booming hotel industry in Biddeford Pool? Well, for one, the Second World War. Another was a distinct shift in values. The social aspect of hotels began to lack appeal in the light of second home options. Most of the adults at this time had lived through the Great Depression and at least one world war. Now, in the post-war economic boom, they were able to afford a second home that they might only use for a few short weeks. These second homes would be the keystone of the seaside industry. And in the words of Peter,
it was very, very common for people to move houses. And even my house, which was originally a stable, was moved from just down the street, the original part of my house. I mean, I can name probably 30 different structures on Biddeford Pool Rome that have been moved around from one place to another, or three places I know of where two houses were put together at some point or another. Somebody picked up a house from somewhere and slammed it into another house. I mean, architecturally, they're just a total disaster.
Which was a common feature at the time, since labor was cheaper than the materials to construct a new house. By the 1950s, the vibrant culture of shore dinner halls was largely gone, replaced by quieter, more private seaside retreats. But their legacy lives on in the stories, artifacts, and memories of those who experienced them. The story of Maine's shore dinner halls is more than just a tale of meals served and artifacts unearthed. It's a reflection of how tourism, community, and the evolving landscape shaped the coast's culture. It was here, at the edge of the world, with the sea in its abundance, that the urban sojourners and native populations met over meals of fish. While the popularity of shore dinners have faded, several objects, albums, and artifacts highlighting their proud history remain. By revisiting this chapter of history, we honor the past and gain insight into the rich tapestry of life along Maine's shores. Thank you for joining us on this journey. Until next time, keep exploring the stories beneath your feet.
Join us next time, where we'll delve into the story of the Mitchell family, owners of the Willows, and key players in Hills Beach tourism. Until then, keep exploring the history all around you.